Now, both Australian and international politics are, to me at least, constantly proving that conversations about nationality, citizenship and especially immigration just very quickly become divisive and polarised. Now, whether we're talking about politicians being caught with dual citizenship through to our current policies around asylum seekers, we become very quickly tribal when it comes to our thinking. So how do we respect diversity without creating division? Now, that is very much the topic of a panel discussion happening at the Ethics Centre tonight, thanks to the Goethe Institute, bringing together a number of German and Australian thinkers and philosophers. One of them is Fritz Breithaupt, a scholar, author, critic, and professor of Germanic studies and affiliated professor of cognitive science at Indiana University Bloomington. Fritz, good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in. Now, this is tonight's chat. Now, it's called Culture and Identity, What's Missing in Contemporary Conversation. And it made me think, back in the 90s, rise of technologies like the internet, we kind of believed, or some of us did at least, maybe we dreamt rather than believing, that we'd become global citizens. You know, we'd sweep away boundaries and borders, but it feels like cultural identity is more important than ever in the contemporary world.
People are looking for orientation, and identity provides such an orientation. I mean, if you have global citizenship where everyone is the same, no one knows what to do, in which direction to turn. And so identity seems to be the one place where people then know, oh, I like these people, I don't like these people. Now, so an identity also has this beautiful function that it means if I have an identity, I do not have to empathize with people who are different from me. I think that's really what's at heart of this matter discussion.
Why do we feel like we need to cut people out, though? This is what's interesting. Why would I use my identity to therefore say, well, you have a separate identity? Why can't we acknowledge the diversity of identities?
I think the demands on us are large. I mean, of course, I would hope that we would reach out to all directions, but I think the demands on our compassion and pity are huge. And so for most people, the easier way out is to say, no, I am this and this kind of guy, so therefore these others are not as interesting for me.
Now, I do know in cognitive science there's often I think it's a fairly contested theory that we actually have a very strong limitation for what empathy and understanding we can give other people around us based on the idea of ideal village sizes. Is that a bit of junk science?
Well, there's this number of 150 that
That's
people
the
talk
one,
about.
Yes.
Yes. I don't think it's fully junk science. Though it doesn't have to be village. People can have some empathy. But what is interesting about this also is that why actually do we have empathy? Why do we have even this village around us? Is it good for the village or is it good for us? And I think the primary answer is that empathy and similar things are good for us. It feels great to reach out to these people, but well, that's good for the others. Yeah, not always.
Well, I was going to touch on your book, which in English, I believe, is translated to the Dark Sides of Empathy. Now, of course, when we have a lot of division, when, you know, especially Westerners see the treatment of other people, see our own treatment of asylum seekers, we often think if we could just understand them, we wouldn't be treating them this way. You, as I understand it, suggest that maybe empathy can have a darker side to it.
Empathy can have many dark sides. So talking about refugees, I mean, we in the panel tonight, we'll talk about, of course, the German situation. Germany opened up its borders. We let in millions of people. I mean, this is now looking at Australia with your islands. It's different situations. But was this empathy? No. It was people wanted to feel good about themselves. They identified with the hero helpers and with our chancellor who let people in. But really understanding those people, no, they're now part of this culture. And that worked out, interestingly. But empathy, it is not. There are other really dark sides of empathy. Mm. There's empathic sadism, for example.
The idea that to truly humiliate someone, it works better if you truly understand them.
Yes, and you also may want to torture people in order to feel empathy with them. Because once they suffer, you know exactly how they're feeling, and you can share the feeling of that.
Well, that is quite remarkable. I hadn't considered that.
This is an open book for me. Once you start talking about dark side, vampirism, helicopter parents, they live their youth again through their kids and send their kids into whatever situations because they want to feel it.
Now, a utilitarian might say that it doesn't matter whether we're using empathy to make ourselves feel better. It is the end result of people being treated well that matters.
Yes, and we know, luckily, that empathy has a moderate correlation to helping behavior. So it does some good, but there's also a lot of bad.
A moderate correlation?
Only a moderate. It's less than we would hope for. I mean, you were starting out talking about your dream of the utopian globalization and so on. There's a moderate hope that this might happen.
Is the idea of us actually being able to recognise diversity of identities without becoming divisive around it, without tribalising, is that just an impossible dream? Is that a utopia? In the sense of an imaginary, made-up impossibility.
I fear there's many limitations. I think the real hope is that we won't be violent in the future. But I think people take sides. I mean, whenever you see people interacting with each other, you take a side, take the perspective of these people, identify, and then the others become demonized. Terrorists are made with that dynamic of empathy and side-taking. And I think that's, we won't stop that dynamic in general of side-taking and polarizations. But we can stop the cycle of violence, of aggressions that come out of that, that result from it.
Well, I was going to say, because tonight's talk is part of a series called Responsibility and Humanity, Nature, Culture and Terror. The responsibility is interesting to me. Do we have responsibilities as a global society?
Yes, we do. We do. Absolutely. That is something that I would say that is the only hope we have. It doesn't mean that we have taken this responsibility on us yet, but it is something that where I would say, yeah, that's where things will happen. And the world is getting a safer place. I mean, with all the dark news we are getting all the times, violence has been decreasing every 100 years, every century for several millennia, and every decade it's also going down. So we are heading somehow in a strange way that we don't understand in the right direction.
What about little bubbles of violence? Like we've seen the incredible division just within America with its own population culturally. Mm-hmm. That fascinates me because sort of, you know, they are managing to other their own selves.
Yes, exactly.
How?
Well, the how part is the easy part. The difficult question that we'll try to talk about tonight is how do you break out of it?
Yeah.
I mean, I live in America for more than 20 years now, and there we really have two social bubbles. I mean, people only kind of see what they see. I mean, on Facebook, everyone is in one on the other side, and that's it. I mean, so they don't know what's going on the other side anymore.
I think that is my great fear, is that the technology we thought would educate and illuminate all of us has actually limited our understanding.
Yes, I think there's some truth to that. Absolutely, because we can filter now. We filter out whom we do not want to see any longer. So we all become narcissists.
Do you think we could have predicted this rise of nationalism in America? I mean, everyone seems to very much stand around scratching their head saying, I can't believe it got to this. Were there the warning signs there that we should have been seeing?
Well, here comes the German perspective from this. I mean, Germany, of course, is the one place where nationalism is basically really kind of something where I would say it's an absolute taboo. We can't really go there. I mean, other maybe in the soccer sports team, but that's about it.
That's it, yes.
That's it.
The Olympics. Line is there. Yeah.
So now, coming as a German to America, of course, they never went through something like that. They won every war, and even Vietnam, they've kind of
flipped it
somehow, the tail that they are coming out as the winner. So they didn't have to reflect about their own identity as a nation. So for me, there were lots of warning signs about it. I mean, the kids in the school, pledging allegiance to the flag every morning. There's some naive kind of belief in the rightness of the nation. And then, you know, at some point it will be whitewashed. I mean, even when the country is involved in bad things, there will be enough people who will try to pretend that they're still doing the right things simply because they always do the right things. And so that's how polarization starts.
Well, I know you're going to get into it tonight, which I cannot wait for. It is starting off at 6 p.m. at the Ethics Centre, which is in Castlereagh Street in Sydney. The talk tonight is Culture and Identity, What's Missing in Contemporary Conversation. I actually have a double pass to give away. If you would love to get your hands on that, give me a call right now, 95149500, 95149500. Fritz Breithaupt, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to have you, Nick. I mean, great to be
a great
I felt like a host. German invaders.